All right, how's everybody doing? We are back for the second episode of day. Hopefully everybody is doing well. And if you didn't catch the first episode, which was about an hour ago, you can check that out on Chicago Jazz Magazine Facebook page. So check all of that out. Of course, it's on Chicago Music Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com, and the Director of Programming and Entertainment at the soon-to-be-opening Epiphany Center for the Arts, right there, 201 South Ashland Avenue. As I always mention on the show, we have got a lot of great performances coming up. We're going to kick it off starting September 1 in a very COVID-safe environment. So for everyone that wants to get information and get up to date and understand what's happening, and be sure you're on our mailing list, visit epiphanychi.com. All right, now, this is an exciting show. We've got a jazz master on the show here, Derek Gardner. He's going to jump on here. I'm going to bring him up on the screen right now. We're going to talk all about the brand new recording that just came out, Still I Rise, from the Big Dig Band. And I am very interested to tell everyone, first off, all about the Big Dig Band. This recording, we've got to talk all about your career. Well, Derek, how are you?
I'm just fine. Thank you very much for having me. Glad to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I should preface, you know, you've obviously toured the world, played everywhere. You've also lived in New York, but we'll get back to the Chicago angle because you grew up in Chicago and came out of Chicago, and your dad's a famous trumpeter here in Chicago too. But before we start going down those wormholes, because you and I probably talk about Andy's, the Green Mill Jazz Showcase and everything else for 45 minutes, why don't we talk about the new recording, Still I Rise, and it's the Big Dig Band. And from what I read about the Big Dig Band, it's a monthly community band that has been put together, and you do a workshop and then you record. But before we get into that, why don't we talk a little bit about Still I Rise and the thought process and who it's devoted to?
It's devoted to the great poet, civil rights activist, Maya Angelou. And one of her poems that that always really stuck with me was her poem, Still I Rise. Mm-hmm. And when she passed away in 2014, it just struck me as such to go to the piano and write this tune. Her hands just kind of came down and came out of my head and said, write this, you know. When I was getting ready for this recording, I said, you know what, I'm going to expand this and turn it into a big band arrangement for this record. And it just kind of made sense to dedicate this thing to her. I kind of look at my writing in some ways as a form of activism. Mm-hmm. And that poem really talks about the plight of African Americans in America throughout the entire throughout their entire existence, from the days of slavery all the way up to now. And so I just thought it was fitting to dedicate this record and that tune to her.
Talk a little bit about the structure of it, because I read about the background of it, and I think it's really interesting because you wrote it and it's the circle of fourths, if I remember correctly, and it doesn't ever resolve. Is that what it was? And there's a reason why, there's a meaning behind it?
Yeah. It just goes around the circle of fourths, I think, about not around the entire circle, around the circle, and then I put like a 2-5 bridge on it, with like a little bit of other kind of unorthodox kind of chord progression after the 2-5 sequence, and then went back to the circle of fourths thing, and then went back to the bridge a little bit and altered that bridge to make it like kind of a C section. Mm-hmm. And so it worked out really, really nice, and that kind of speaks to, you know, kind of speaks to her resilience as a poet and how she put her words together, you know.
I like the backstory on that when I was reading through the information that I was about the recording. I mean, you really went in depth to think about, when you were putting this together, all of these little meanings within this one tune. Now it's a full recording, right? So we should make sure everyone knows that, or is it just
oh, yeah.
So what is it about? Because I looked at and I saw clips and bits and pieces of it. So why don't you talk a little bit about the full recording too? I mean, how many tracks and all of that, because it's quite an undertaking.
Yeah, well, there are, well, you know, nowadays, everything is released online, you know, and which is good in some respects, and, you know, kind of, you know, good one hand, not good another. But the good thing about it is that you can, you're not limited by the amount of space on a compact disc.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you choose to go the vinyl route, you're not limited, you know. So I released the full CD of 10 tracks online. And on the physical CD, which is kind of a limited run, has seven of those 10 tracks.
And so now this is the Big Dig Band, the recording. And so let's talk about the Big Dig Band. I mean, what's the concept behind this? I read about the background of it, and it sounds fascinating. You sort of based it off of what Mingus used to do with his jazz workshops back in the 50s and 60s. So talk. And by the way, you're in Winnipeg. So is this based around the college students, or is there a lot of heavy duty players in Winnipeg too, as far as players go that come into the community big band?
Winnipeg has a wonderful a jazz scene up here. Unfortunately, the outlets to play jazz are not that numerous as say or New York or some place like that, but there are quite a few really great jazz musicians, and there's a lot of support for jazz here. You got the Winnipeg Jazz Orchestra, the Winnipeg Jazz Festival. We have two or three other professional big bands around town, and you have a few that feature jazz maybe once or twice a week, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there's quite a bit of support up here for jazz. Tons of support, actually.
It's actually really grown up there. You and I talked a little bit before we came on, and I talked to Steve Kirby at a old IAJE convention, and he was talking about getting this program going. Now you're there, and it seems like it's really, it's like a burgeoning jazz city, and what a great place to be able to go and study with somebody like yourself and the rest of the faculty, and be like in Winnipeg. I mean, I've been there a couple of times. That's a fun town.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And if you're from Chicago, like both of us are, you're kind of Chicago serves as an orientation to the cold. And but
yeah, right.
But up here, this is professional grade up here. This is professional grade.
So you're not standing outside in January playing your trumpet for fun at all, huh?
No, I am not.
Well, tell me about the community big band idea and how it's developed into the fact that you can put an entire recording out.
Well, you were very correct in that we fashioned this band after the Mingus big band workshops, and we were quite successful with that throughout the run of about 3 years or so. Mm-hmm. And we would do the first set as a workshop, and we marketed it as a composer's jam session. And so we would invite composers from locally and regionally and across the country to come in and feature their music. We workshop it, and then we included our concert program on the second set.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out really well. You know, it really put the musicians here in Winnipeg weren't used to anything like that. You know, not too many musicians around the country are used to doing anything like that, you know, live in front of people. So it really put everybody on their toes, and it gave the audience great insight into the creative process, how we put a whole program together, and how we just kind of mold and fashion the whole thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really worked out very well until our funding ran out, you know, because that's another thing about Winnipeg and Canada in general. They have so many incredible financial support for the arts up here through grant funding, and which is how I was able to fund this recording.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say this through Manitoba Film and Music, Canada Council for the Arts, the school where I teach, University of Manitoba, and the foundation assisting Canadian talent on record, Factor.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So those four entities funded this record.
Wow.
And really made it, really brought this dream to fruition, you know.
Well, I gotta ask, because I mean, just talking about the workshop and then performing. So the workshop, and you're doing the workshop in front of people, and then you perform the second set. I mean, had you ever done anything like that? Like, I mean, until you created it. I mean, you know, I've read about it, like the Mingus thing and stuff. But yeah. I mean, did you ever experience anything like that?
The closest thing I came to that was actually performing and touring with the Mingus Band when I was mm-hmm. living in New York, but. We never rehearsed anything new because we were doing all of Mingus's old arrangements, so they were pretty much staples within the band, you know.
Yeah.
So we decided to take it all the way back to the bare roots of creativity, you know. And it was now we didn't know that first set was, you know, kind of sketchy at times, you know, but. But we tried to get it together by the second set. You know?
Well, what a way to do it, though. I mean, once you do it a couple of times, you know, I always ask players, and I ask, you know, I mean, a player like yourself who's played with all of these, you know, first of all, you've led your own bands, and then you've also played with like heavy duty groups and heavy duty leaders. When you step on the stage, boom, I mean, you can't like ease into it like it's like a restaurant gig. It's like, boom, it's on, it's you, let's go, you're on fire. That's kind of like, to me, this workshop thing really kind of makes you, if you're not used to doing that, once you do it once, you know you got to bring your game, and you're like not warming up on the first couple of tunes. You are blowing, it's go time. That's probably one of the biggest things that you're simulating for some of these students and some of the people that aren't used to playing like you're used to playing. Like, they're like, oh my God, I gotta have my stuff together right off the bat, right?
Yeah, that's true. To add another layer of frosting on top of that, you've got to find some way to make it for the audience. A rehearsal can be quite boring, you know, if you really get into the nuts and bolts of it. So we had to figure out some way to make this, you know, crack a few jokes and, you know, make it somewhat entertaining, you know, to the audience.
Well, it's a great way to have students actually simulate an actual gig. Cause I mean, you know, you get out of college and all of a sudden you go play a gig with some older cats and they're looking at you like, are you out of your mind? I mean, what are you doing? You know, you're doing everything wrong because, well, it didn't happen this way in Jazz 101. What's going on? So then they, you know, it takes a little while to get up to speed. So this kind of thing really kicks the students and kicks people that aren't quite up like that. It gives them a great simulation of what an actual gig would be like if you were playing professionally.
Yeah, exactly.
So talk a little bit about the band. So how often do you guys meet? How often does this happen? And what was the process to record this? Was this just one set? Did you just record the set and you guys played it? Or did you record over time and then put the whole thing together?
No, this was done over the course of 5 days. We did 3 days of rehearsal and 2 days of recording.
Wow.
And the band is... you know, the band kind of began and ended, you know, we began in 2014, ended around 2016. And then we always wanted, Steve and I always wanted like some type of a musical product that was associated with Dig Magazine. Dig Magazine was the kind of our, you're familiar with the magazine Hot House in New York.
Sure.
It was like a little ass periodical for, you know, local. And so Steve created that magazine here in Winnipeg, and it never had any like a product associated with the magazine. So I said, man, let's start a big band. And so, kind of put our money where all of our words are coming into this magazine. And so we never got a chance to record. And so I always wanted to record the band. So then since that time, Steve has retired. Mm-hmm. And I said, I still want to associate this this music with Dig Magazine, and Dig Magazine still exists online, and we're about to turn it into a blog, actually.
Oh, nice.
So I'd like to boast that this is the only band of any kind, of any genre, that's associated with a periodical of its same, of the same subject matter, you know, a jazz periodical.
Nice. Well, I mean, I started Chicago Jazz Magazine, and there's no way anybody could talk me into starting a big band to go along with the jazz. I had enough stuff going on. I didn't need to also start dealing with a big band. So congratulations to you guys. And you're alive to talk about it even. So that's even better.
Sure, right.
Hey, where can everybody see that? Is it digmagazine.com or something? Or is it
digmagazine.com.
Okay, yeah. digmagazine.com.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, digmagazine.ca.
.ca for Canada?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Oh, well, we'll link that up for sure. That's incredible. You know, we just real fast, Chicago Jazz Magazine was print for like 17 years, and then we went digital about 2.5 years ago. So, I mean, right. You know, it's the way of the world. But your readership's going to explode, too, because, you know, people are all over, all online now. So it really, especially for this kind of music, you're going to reach people throughout the entire world now, which is incredible, you know. So I'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about your career. So first, you grew up in Chicago, and you left Chicago to go to New York in 1991. Was that, like, right after high school, or how did you end up in Chicago?
Actually, I was born in Chicago. And then like I mentioned earlier, both my parents are musicians, and my father, jazz trumpeter in the area, Burgess Gardner, and both my parents went back to school and got their doctorates, and we both they both got jobs in Virginia.
Oh.
And so we moved the whole family in Virginia to Virginia when I was about eighth grade.
Okay.
And so I never had a chance to really be on the scene in Chicago until much later when I was teaching at Michigan State University, and I would come up to visit my dad, and I'd consequently be doing some gigs in Chicago with Jeff Lindbergh.
Oh, Jeff Lindbergh. Oh, yeah, sure. The Chicago Jazz Orchestra.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And in other places, I go sit in the Andes and go out to hang out at the Showcase and Green Mill and everything.
Yep.
And that was my only real time during that maybe 6 or 7 years I was in Michigan that I was kind of like going back and forth between Michigan and Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to being in Michigan, I came to Michigan from New York. I had been in New York about 11 years or so, and had toured with the Count Basie Orchestra, and
that's when Frank Foster was there, right? I mean, Frank was running it, right? I mean, that was a smoking band.
Oh yeah, we had a ball. That was actually my first gig, my first professional gig was with
Count really Basie. That was your first professional gig was with the Count Basie Orchestra with Frank Foster running it. Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. And my mother got me the gig. Believe it or not.
All right, wait a minute. How did she get you the gig? I just got it. You can tell us the fast version, but how did she get you the gig?
Okay. Basie Band's looking for a school to house Basie's archives. My mother, chairperson of the music department at Hampton University, where I did my undergraduate school in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And so they're doing those meetings, setting that up. And then they asked my old trumpet teacher there, his name was Bob Ransom, say, hey, Bob, you want to go out with the Basie Band? We got a chair open, you know? Chicago trumpeter Sonny Cone.
Okay, sure, yeah.
Had retired, you know, from the band, and so he had a chair open. And Mr. Ransom was like, "No, I'm too old for that stuff. I'm not going out with the band." He said, "Call Dr. Gardner, son. He's ready to go. Go call him." You know. And at the time, I was in Indiana at the center with David Baker.
At IU
program out there.
Yeah,
and,
at IU.
So my mother called me, hey, you're going to get the gig with the Basie Band. I said, what have you been smoking? I said, you don't know anybody. You know? She said, look, you're going to get the gig with the Basie Band. And so so about 3 hours later, Frank Foster called me. I'm like, oh, my God, it's Frank Foster. You know? And I got the gig.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, oh, man. Well, I can only imagine your mom, you know, telling you that, hey, you remember who got you this gig, right?
Yeah, right.
So you were with the Basie band, and then you ended up, were you with Harry Connick Jr. too, right? I mean, was that right after the Basie band?
No, that was some years later.
Okay.
I think that must have been about, I left the Basie band in 95 or 96, I think. And then I didn't join Connick until around 2000, I think.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
That was that Basie band. I mean, you guys were, I remember you guys were on a bus, right? I mean, you guys were doing the whole road thing and playing a ton of concerts. I mean, because I remember when Frank was running it, and I, you know, I was back in Chicago, and I mean, you guys would play all over Illinois, all over Indiana, all over the states, everywhere. You just one after one.
Yeah.
That had to be an incredible experience, not only playing those charts, but playing with some of those guys in that band and being around them for that amount of time and always playing, right? I mean, that had to be like the changing deal in your playing, I would imagine.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Incredibly. I mean, on all fronts. That's what I thought I was going to. I actually, you know, I was stupid enough to think that I was going to stop learning when I left graduate school when I was in Indiana. And little that I know that's when the learning began.
Yeah.
When I got on the road with them. And that was a big boost in my, and just across the board, my entire musicianship level just rose incredibly. Mm-hmm. And especially with arranging. Frank Foster was my mentor as far as like my arranging, and he would real quickly he would be on the bus in the front of the bus with a giant score pad, you know, just pre-finale, you know, with a black felt tip pen, and he's going saxophones dee da dee da da da, trumpets dee da da, trombone dee da da, and saxophone dee da 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 da, with no piano. You know, it's all in his head. And I'm looking at him like, oh, my God, that's incredible. And so I said, okay, maybe I can do that. So I give me a big and I start going saxophone, da 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 da. And so I got a few measures, you know, about 8 measures, you know, 16 measures done. And 2 weeks later, I went to Foss, to the front of the bus, and said, hey, Foss, man, would you take a look at this? And he said, okay, let me take a look at it. And so he's looking at it, and then he grabs the cap from his black pen and puts it on his pen, puts it in his pocket. Then he grabs his red pen, takes the cap off, and just starts bleeding all over my page. Why'd you got the third here? The third, now you guys are the fifth. Okay, now you got to put the seventh up here. Why you got the major throw and the minor third? You got to change this here. That should be B flat, not B natural. But, and he's just, oh man, he just cut my whole thing up. It's like, okay, here, work on that. So, like, what? Yeah, man. So I went back to the back of the bus, man. Just, you know, tail between my legs, but by the time I got to a piano, like later that day or whatever, I worked it out. And then a couple weeks later, I made the corrections. They have a few more measures done. And say, hey, Foss, would you check this out? I had a red pen, and that time I didn't have as much blood on my page.
You know, so. You know what's cool though is that, I mean, he, you know, he came up in that generation too, man, where he wanted to give back. You know what I mean? He was like, he's looking at this thing, and he's probably could have just said, go sit down, get out of here. But instead, he like corrected it and spent some time and talked to you and told, you know, here, go work on this and work on that. You know?
Oh, he was definitely from that ideology, man. It's like trying to pass the whole thing on, you know.
Yeah.
And boy, did he ever! You know, anybody who wanted to learn it, he was like, "Yeah, okay, let's do this." And he had a lot of arrangers from within the band that were contributing music as well to the book. That during that period when Frank Foster was running the band, that was the most. New arrangements were contributed to the book, as comparatively to when Basie was alive and Frank and Thad Jones and Jimmy Mundy, Neil Hefti, Quincy Jones, all those people were contributing all this new music. That stopped, you know, until basically until Frank Foster got in the leadership and started just putting more music in the band. You know?
Yeah. Well, he went back to what he was doing when he was in the band, right? I mean, he was why are we not adding to the catalog here? Let's go, you know? I mean, and I think of that era as the reason why the Basie band continued on, right? Because, I mean, it didn't get stale thanks to Frank, probably, because he was contributing and pushing it and stuff. You know, I saw them in Carnegie Hall, back in 90, 91, and I couldn't believe what I was watching. I mean, it was smoking, you know. I don't think you were in the band yet, but it had to be 1990. So yeah,
I joined in 91.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Oh, it was wow. What an experience. And then, so I mean, doing all of that, and then you played with so many different musicians, but then you also started your own group, the Jazz Prophets, right? Is that what that came out of? Like you wanted to start writing your own stuff. So you created you got your own band together.
Yep. Exactly.
Talk a little bit about the Jazz Prophets. I mean, reading about it, you started it, what, back in the early 90s, and you continued pushing it forward even when you were traveling with the Basie band and beyond that.
Sure. When I got to New York, it was my dream to be a jazz messenger. I wanted that Blakey gig so bad, man, you know. But I got to New York a year too late. Blakey had died the year before, I think in 1990, I believe.
Okay.
But I always loved that sound of the configuration of the messenger band with the trumpet, tenor, and trombone. Mm-hmm. So I kind of fashioned my band after that, kind of centered around my writing and anybody else that wanted to contribute things to the book. I got a couple opportunities to record the band. First one was a self-produced recording called Slim Goody, and then the next two were by a label that's located in Indianapolis called Owl Studios. Mm-hmm. And they recorded my next two albums. And my brother, Vincent Gardner, who's lead trombonist with the Lincoln Center Band. Mm-hmm. He's in it. And Indianapolis tenor player, who was also in New York at the time, his name was Robert Dixon. And who else? Gerald Cannon's on bass and Donald Everett on drums and Anthony Wanzi, Chicago, from Chicago as well.
Oh, yeah.
Anthony Wanzi on piano.
Oh, nice. So, yeah. I mean, so are you still keeping that kind of happening when you're up in Winnipeg, or it's too hard to travel back and forth, or too hard to get anything happening with that group now?
Yeah, too hard to get anything happening with that group. We occasionally I'll get something down in the States where they want the Prophets to play at like a college or university or somewhere and turn it into like a master class thing, you know. And so I've been able to do that a couple of times, but I'm looking to apply some of this grant funding to record the Jazz Prophets again as well.
Nice. Well, that's great. Yeah. That's great. And I mean, you're up at the University of Manitoba. And before we wrap up, of course, I'm here with Derek Gardner. We should tell everybody, although I have a link right here on the screen, everybody should head over to DerekGardnerMusic.com to pick up the new release, Still I Rise, but then also check out all of the different things we're talking about. He's got a great website up there, and you'll be able to pick up a lot of different things and find out more about Derek if you're not familiar with him. You're probably, some of you people that are watching this right now are familiar with his father, so I mean, you know, you can head over to Derek's website and get all the information about all the releases and everything we're talking about. But I mean, you're up at the University of Manitoba kind of finishing out the year because of COVID on Zoom and all of those things. So what's the situation with the jazz program up there? It sounds like you and I talked before we came on. It sounds like it's in a lot better situation up there with COVID than it is here. So are you anticipating being able to be back in person in the classroom in the fall when you kick things back up?
I think they're kind of piecing it together as the summer has progressed, as we get closer to the fall semester. And we've been kind of preparing for the worst, being that everything is going virtual. And then, but I think they're starting to realize that, okay, maybe we can have, I think maybe one private lesson every couple weeks or every month, and then the other lessons will be virtual. Up until the one private lesson. Yeah. And then we're trying to figure out what to do with the ensembles, you know, because you can't gather in those large groups. But what I'm going to do, I direct the University of Manitoba Jazz Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And what I'm going to do is we're going to create like a virtual big band, you know, where you will have everybody going to this our the studio that, that's in our school mm-hmm. and just lay down their part, you know.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And so that presents like a totally new educational situation for them to learn how to record, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
So, so now that, so that's, so I look at it as an opportunity rather than like like something that's handicapping us, you know.
Well, you know, and it's interesting to me because I've talked to a lot of musicians and I feel this same way, and I'm curious just to get your quick thoughts on it. But I think that the one silver lining out of this whole situation with COVID-19 and shutting everything down is that musicians who never had time to figure out the digital world because they're running from one gig to another or a lesson to a lesson,
yeah,
or any of that stuff, they actually had to figure it out. And I think there's a lot of good stuff starting to come out of this live streaming thing, meaning you're able to connect with a lot of different audiences than you would have ever even thought about. Cause you know, everybody's running from one gig to another or class to a class or, but I mean, I found so much new music online just because people are doing it consistently and they're learning how to do it so that it's a little bit, the presentation's a little bit better. So, you know, I mean, what are your thoughts? Are you seeing that?
Yeah. I'm definitely seeing that. It has upped, for me personally, it has upped my entire technology skills, like, you know, tenfold,
yeah,
you know? And it presents new opportunities. I don't think it's going to be very difficult to go back to how things were before.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to totally switch over to, like, this new virtual existence for all the universities, but I'm positive that that universities are going to be employing some aspects of this, you know, on a very serious matter, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, if nothing else, it makes it a lot easier for you to have like a 15-minute consultation with a student in between private lessons or something. You can jump on a Zoom thing. I mean, just those little interactions really helps, I'm sure. You know, they're able to ask you a question and say, hey, what do you check this out? And in 10 minutes, you can say, sounds great. Don't do that. Fix that. I'll see you at the next lesson.
Yeah.
You know, I see that happening a lot more probably.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right.
Well,
right.
Derek, it's been a pleasure connecting with you virtually, and hopefully we will get to see you perform here in Chicago sometime in the near future, actually in person. What a concept that would be to be actually in person performing, right? But hey, man, congratulations on the new release. I Rise. Everything's available at DerekGardnerMusic.com. And, you know, it's great to connect. I'm glad we connected. So you let me know if something else pops and we'll have to have you come back. And, you know, maybe we'll just check in with you in February and see what the weather's like. It'll make us feel better.
That's right. It will definitely. I'll be a block of ice.
All right, man. Hey, pleasure talking to you and congratulations.
Okay. Thanks, man.
All right. Thanks.
Okay.
All right, Derek Gardner. What a pleasure, man. And, you know, I got to thank Leah Liebman for hooking us up and connecting us with all these great people here and, throughout the show. She's helped a ton. And, you know, so thank you, Lydia. But what a show. What two shows today. Holy cow. Episode 69. We had a great, great show. Now, tomorrow, Dave Bryant is on the air tomorrow. We're going to be talking about his new release, and we will be back here at the normal time of 6 p.m. right here, Central Standard Time, Chicago Music Revealed, and it'll be episode 70. Not that I have anything special planned for episode 70, but it'll be episode 70. Of course, as I always say, everybody stay safe, everybody stay healthy. Check out all the live music that's starting to happen here in Chicago. Andy's, Green Mill, go check it out. Fitzgerald's up and running. So, until next time, I will see you tomorrow on the broadcast.